Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School. This is your Hedge School Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. Now, today's topic is History, Memory, and Bloody Sunday, 1920. Within 15 hours, on Sunday, 21st of November, 1920, 32 people would die in Dublin. In the morning, 11 British intelligence officers killed by Michael Collins' squad, plus two auxiliaries and two civilians. In the afternoon, 14 civilians killed by British forces at Croke Park, including player Michael Hogan of Tipperary. And that evening, in murky circumstances in Dublin Castle, two high-ranking IRA officers, Dick McKee and Paddy Clancy, and civilian Conor Clune. Did these events mark a decisive turning point in the ongoing War of Independence? How were they represented at the time? How are they remembered today? And we're joined by Fergal McGarry of Queen's University Belfast, Brian Handley, Trinity College Dublin, Joe Connell, a regular contributor to History Ireland and author of The Shadow War, Michael Collins and the Politics of Violence. And later we'll be joined by Siobhan Doyle of the GAA Museum. And this Hedge School, in association with the GAA Museum, is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media, all of them, under the Decade of Centenaries initiative. Now, just to get started, let's start with a quote. "We have murder by the throat," so boasted Lloyd George at London's Guildhall in a speech on the 9th of November, 1920. Joe Connell, to what extent was this true? Did they have the IRA by the throat?
Well, first of all, Tommy, we're talking about Dublin in this Hedge School tonight, but let's not forget that around Ireland, there was an awful lot going on at the very same time in Cork, Limerick, down south, down in the west. And those things continued. But in Dublin itself, it seemed like there might have been a little bit of a lull in 1920. You had Forbes Redmond, who was killed by the IRA in January. You had several spies who were trying to be infiltrated into Michael Collins, Jameson, Quinlisk, Mike of Fergus Molloy. They were all killed in February and March, and then Alan Bell was killed in March of 1920. And then there seemed to be a little bit of a lull. There weren't these kinds of bloody incidents on the street. So Lloyd George could have looked, I'm not sure he did, but he could have just looked at Dublin and said, look, the activities are going way down. We have them by the throat. They're stopping. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't an awful lot going on in Dublin. It was more sub rosa, because right in October of 1920, in your area, you had the big raid with Sean Tracy and Dan Breen, who had that big shootout there. So there was a lot going on in Dublin that might not have been noticed by the British at the time. They had a lot of raids going on from September on. They had a great number of people who were talking to the Irish. The Irish certainly knew that there was a squad of people coming from Dublin in order to take over intelligence people. So there was a lot going on that might not have been apparent on the surface that there would have been other times when you had more executions of G Division officers or something like that. I do not think that what Lloyd George said was true. Obviously, we take a look at 2 and 3 weeks later, and it's proven not to be true. But maybe he took a look at the lull in September and the summer of 1920 and thought that was what was appropriate for his audience.
Okay, let's bring Fergal in on this, Fergal McGarry. Okay, there's a lull in Dublin, right? So from the British point of view, did they make a mistake of believing their own propaganda, perhaps? I mean, could you put this in a national context, if you could?
Well, I don't know if the British did believe their own propaganda. There was a range of views among the British, just as there was on the Irish side. and particularly within both military forces. I mean, both sides have their hawks and their doves at this point. Some senior army figures definitely believe that they were winning the war. And I think any objective sort of appraisal of what's going on is that they were making progress in lots of respects by the summer and autumn of 1920. On the other hand, though, you have some military figures who really are have quite politically astute positions. Neville McCready would be one of them, and they believe that only a political settlement will ultimately resolve the Irish question. I think if you're looking at the wider picture, you know, November can be seen as a really important turning point. Very importantly, I think David Lloyd George's murder by the throat rhetoric begins to look rather hollow. You've got the hanging of Kevin Barry on the 1st of November, Bloody Sunday, which we're obviously going to be exploring, taking place on the 21st of November, and then I think very important event, Kilmichael, on the 28th of November. And I think even amongst the sort of the militarists, the hawks, and some of the diehard Tories who would be very hostile to Irish nationalism, very hostile to the idea of a political settlement, you do begin to see a much greater realism that what's going on in Ireland has deep-rooted support and that there's potential for it to last for quite a long time. And that really begins to affect what I think is quite a slow shift to greater realism about the need for some kind of political settlement, which means shifting beyond home rule and thinking about some kind of more painful kind of political settlement. So I think all of that sort of comes into place over the course of November, December.
Now, Fergal, just say a little bit, just in case we don't get a chance to get back to this, just the international situation, because, of course, the year before, there was the infamous massacre at Amritsar in India.
Yeah, I mean, I think the international context is hugely important. I mean, how the reprisals were reported abroad was enormously significant in terms of its longer-term impact on British policy. I think that's a key factor which really undermined. So British policy is really undermined by how it plays in the world media and how it plays diplomatically and crucially in the United States. A really important event to think about, which takes place just before the period we're looking at today, is Terence McSweeney's death. And there's probably no other single event which has such an important kind of global impact. We also have Kevin Barry's hanging, getting enormous press coverage in Britain and internationally. And all of this has a really big impact on how the war, how the conflict is seen. And even figures like Churchill are quite bullish about the war, are really aware that the media attention is extremely damaging. As soon as Bloody Sunday happened, people were making parallels with Amritsar, which took place in April 1919. I think there's some important differences. The scale of violence is obviously very different. There were 400, maybe a lot more, fatalities in India. The British response is actually in some ways more clear-cut to Amritsar. The official Hunter report criticises General Dyer, who was responsible for what happened, and the Punjab government. Dyer certainly had his defenders, and the whole thing was quite controversial in how it played out in Britain, but his career was ended and he was kind of disgraced, and the army did acknowledge Amritsar as a failing, whereas, as we're going to see with Bloody Sunday, it's much more kind of ambivalent. I think one of the first people to draw connections between Amritsar and Bloody Sunday's De Valera, and that's kind of interesting because he's in the United States, and I think the context there is he's Irish Americans, Irish nationalists in America are forming alliances with Indian nationalists, with Egyptians and so on, and there is a sense that the Irish issue is being framed as part of a kind of a wider anti-colonial or anti-imperial crisis. And that brings us maybe to the third point where Amritsar is kind of interesting to think about, which is the idea of the kind of a wider crisis of British Empire. So you've got certainly on the British side figures like Sir Henry Wilson, who see a connection between labour unrest in Britain, between Bolshevism and the Russian Revolution, and then between anti-colonial and nationalist uprisings taking place from Ireland to Egypt. And there's a core idea here, which is, you know, the empire is under attack. If you lose one part of it, if you lose Ireland, if you lose India, the whole thing is up for grabs. So I think that kind of thinking helps to explain why you see the kind of brutal methods, the formation of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries and so on, because this is seen as a sort of an existential issue for diehards and militarists. Maybe the final point I'd make about Amritsar is it kind of raises interesting questions about race and I suppose also about geography. I mean, the British are responsible for a lot more violence, even, albeit much of the violence was also done by Indian soldiers in India. But they get away with a lot more in places like India and Egypt and the Middle East. I think what's crucial about what's happening in Ireland, I mean, the fatalities are much smaller, but the media coverage is absolutely enormous. And that's because it's taking place, you know, just a short boat ride away from London. Journalists can go across and cover things. But also, I think there's an element of racial thinking, that it's not considered. The same methods that you can use to as part of imperial violence are not considered kind of appropriate in this United Kingdom context against white people. So that's an interesting kind of dimension too, in terms of how Indian and Irish violence plays out differently in terms of the kind of responses that it provokes.
Now, Brian Hanley, can I go to you? I just want to get back to the sort of intelligence war in Dublin. How had the Castle beefed up their intelligence operation over the previous months?
Yeah, I mean, I think Dublin is quite distinct, and Joe has made that point about there's lots going on elsewhere. But if you want to compare it, Dublin is nothing like Belfast in the winter of 1920. Belfast has seen intense intercommunal violence, sniping on a daily basis, assassination, shootings and riots and so on. And Dublin really isn't like that. I mean, the first fatality suffered by the British Army in Dublin came in September 1920 in the attack, which Kevin Barry was hanged for. Previous to that, the IRA in Dublin had not targeted the British Army at all. So it's a different kind of war. And it was based very much on trying to destroy Dublin Castle's intelligence network, which in the beginning was the G Division of the Dublin Metropolitan Police. And that was done very ruthlessly and very effectively by the organisation around Michael Collins from the summer of 1919 onwards. So by the spring of 1920, there clearly has to be a reorganisation. And that's part of a general reorganisation by the British of their security apparatus in Ireland. And Henry Tudor comes over as head of police. He's not particularly qualified for this, but he's a friend of Churchill's. And he appoints a man called Ormond Winter, who's a friend of his. Again, not qualified, but straight out of central casting. If you've ever seen a photograph of him with monocle and so on. A diehard reactionary, certainly regards the Irish with a fair degree of contempt. Does see it very much in terms of a global struggle for the empire, but has new ideas about how they're going to really improve intelligence in Dublin. The problem for the British is that there's different institutions involved. You have Dublin Castle and its intelligence network. You've British Army intelligence, which is not the same body, and which the two bodies don't share information for long periods. You've got what's becoming the Secret Service in London under Basil Thompson, who are also interested in Ireland because it's part of the global picture that Fergal talked about, but again, who are operating independently a lot of the time. And then you've got the Royal Irish Constabulary across the country, who historically would have built up information on rebels and subversives, but who are under severe pressure by 1920 and who are losing a lot of their contacts and so on. And again, I think we probably need to draw out in the discussion what we mean by intelligence agents and military intelligence and spies and informers and so on, because they're not all quite the same thing. And what Ormond Winter wants to do is bring in essentially British officers, usually veterans, and almost all British officers are veterans of the Great War and other conflicts, and use them as intelligence operatives on the streets of Dublin. Now, these guys aren't going to infiltrate the IRA, and the British Army in its own narrative, and it does a very detailed report on this in late 1921, you know, knows that it can't infiltrate the IRA with British-born officers. And again, these guys aren't particularly undercover. I mean, they've got military bearing. And their job is to essentially operate on the streets. In October, Sean Tracy is killed in a gun battle in Talbot Street. Now, these guys are probably involved in that. So these hush-hush men, as Winter refers to them, are not spies in the sense that they're joining the IRA and finding out all its secrets. They're operating on information that's been given to them by other spies and informers or by the remnants of G Division in Dublin Castle. They've got photographs of the players within the Dublin IRA or those they know. They've got some information about them. And one factor which we can't forget, because I think we do emphasise, obviously, certainly the popular image emphasise Collins's agents inside the castle and his agents inside the police. One of the great things about the IRA from a historian's point of view is that they wrote an enormous amount down. In 1920, that was a drawback. The British know a lot about the IRA from what they capture on IRA members. They capture a lot of Richard Mulcahy's papers in 1920, which allows them to identify a lot of key players. And by 1921, you've got people being interned across Ireland on the basis of what the British are discovering from IRA documents. So the IRA has a lot of paperwork, and that paperwork does get captured. So the British have some idea of what they're dealing with by the winter of 1920. And again, we have to take into account the mythologies on all sides about who's winning and so on. But certainly intelligence is revamped, and these guys are British military officers, essentially.
Okay, Joe, can I bring you in here on this? Were they any good, you know, for the job that, they were supposed to do? I mean, I'm thinking of what Brian's saying there about, you know, that the fact that they were operating quite openly. And if we look at the geography of the killings, for example, I mean, they all seem to be holed up in swanky hotels, boarding houses, some of them living with their families. You know, so, you know, how effective were they?
Tommy, we think of British intelligence, English intelligence, going all the way back to Queen Elizabeth I and William Cecil. And we think that the British intelligence or English intelligence, however you want to look at it, has been the sort of the standard by which other countries have been measured. In fact, some of these were trained at Hounslow for a very short period of time. Then they came over to Ireland. There's some indication there was about 175 of them who came over at various times. But they were relying particularly before this on the RIC, on the G Division of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, and particularly on informers. And as Brian was just saying, that didn't work this time. That wasn't where they were going to get their information. What they did was they did an awful lot of things which any intelligence operation, if they were taught anything at Hounslow, this would have been sort of intelligence 101. Don't do these things. We mentioned earlier about Forbes Redmond or Alan Bell. They used the very same transportation every day. Forbes Redmond walked to his hotel on the same route every day. Alan Bell got on the same tram every day. They both died as a result of that. One of the things you want to do is change up what you're going to do. When John Lynch came, and he was really nothing to do with the IRA except he was delivering money of the Doyle loan up to Dublin, he was killed by mistake, probably, but one of the people who was in charge of the intelligence process was Lieutenant Anglis, and he got drunk and despondent with a girlfriend and explained exactly how badly he felt about this. She, of course, passed the information on. You know, we think in terms of sometimes of intelligence operatives being James Bond or Kim Philby or Mata Hari, and in fact, the best, absolute best intelligence agents you'll ever find are the ones that you meet, the ones that you've had a meeting with, the ones you maybe had a drink with, and you leave and you can't even describe what they look like or what they said or what they wore. These individuals did just about everything wrong they could have done in terms of being intelligence agents. But there was a company called the Dublin Services Flats Limited. This was an entity that had a lot of flats for rent around Marion Square, for example, and many of these people lived there. The last thing an intelligence agent wants to do is go into a flat or any kind of a rental premises with other officers, particularly those who are wearing British uniforms.
Joe, just coming back to that, basically you're saying that they seem to have not followed the sort of counterintelligence 101 handbook. Would that account for the rather unsympathetic response of Lloyd George and Churchill when they got the news?
Well, I think so. Lloyd George and Churchill said they were beaten by counter jumpers. They said they were soldiers. They took a soldier's risk. I think they understood that they put themselves in harm's way, if you will, and they didn't really do very much to get out of harm's way. Well, when you take a look at, for example, Upper Mount Street, that was one of the premises that was rented by that organization. You had six British officers living there. You had three people who were killed, two of whom were agents. That's just not it. You know, Brian mentioned earlier the term hush-hush men. Caroline Woodcock was there with her husband. Again, as you suggest, they were living with their families. And although Woodcock was not an intelligence officer, he was dressed in his full regimental uniform going down that morning. And this is the last thing you want to be, is in a place where you're going to be seen like this. She talked in her book about the hush-hush men. But she also talked about something else that was extraordinarily important. There was a curfew in Dublin. These hush-hush men in her book used to leave at all hours of the night and come back early in the morning. All of these people did things like this, which just marked them as intelligence agents. If you were out at 12 o'clock, midnight, in Dublin at this time, you better have a very good reason for it, or you probably were an intelligence officer going on a raid. So their tradecraft was really not very good at all. They didn't do the things they should have done. And in a sense, they caused quite a bit of notice to themselves, which led to their deaths in many cases.
Now, Brian, on the other side of the coin, right, how good was the IRA and Michael Collins's intelligence? In other words, like, what was the base on which you drew up the list of people to be assassinated? And how many were on that list, incidentally, originally?
Well, there was another extra 50. There was 35 targeted on the day, and I think there was 50 originally on the list. Collins had people like Lily Mernan, who was actually his cousin. And again, when you think about that in security terms, she was working in Dublin Castle, and she's the cousin of Michael Collins. But she and a number of others, obviously David Nelligan, Ned Bryan, and so on, were inside the apparatus of Dublin Castle and so on, and they were providing information. Then you had, what's very important is that your people on the street, so common among activists who worked in restaurants or in cafes that were frequented by British soldiers or by police officers and so on. You had newsboys selling papers on the street who were like looking out for something that looked unusual, people who were in the company of the police or the army. And you have essentially what's very unglamorous in many ways, or very, doesn't again fit into this whole James Bond idea of espionage, but it's simply people who are working in pubs or in cafes or in hotels who are picking up information and passing it on. And who, if one of these officers is seen talking to a known police officer, for example, and so on, and somebody notices this, this is passed on to somebody in the IRA. And ultimately, if things are working well, it's passed on to the intelligence department, of which Michael Collins is the director. So they're building up over the summer of 1920. They know that Dublin Castle, and they know that the Crown Forces are revamping their intelligence. So they're trying to revamp their intelligence as well and get to grips with this. Now, the wider plan for the day was that this was a counter-reprisal. This was part of a whole series of operations that were really going to give the lie to Lloyd George's claim that he had murder by the throat. And this would involve operations in Britain and so on. Now, when Ernie O'Malley was captured a few months later, one of the documents he had on him was a document about this. So it was just as well he wasn't captured beforehand. So again, this was out there within the ranks of the IRA that something was going to happen. And there were going to be operations in Britain itself, some of which went ahead, most of which didn't. And there were going to be these targeted strikes in Dublin. Now, I think there were originally 50 names, as I said. Cathal Brua, who was Minister for Defence, and in theory was Collins' superior, although they had a pretty antagonistic relationship. Brua didn't think there was enough evidence to shoot 15 of these men, so their names were taken off. And ultimately, there was 35, which was still a pretty big operation. And again, it's the scale of this is very, very big for the Dublin IRA. It's far too big for Collins' squad, for example. You know, so that's why the entire IRA in Dublin had to be brought into the planning and the operation itself around Bloody Sunday.
Fergal, can I bring you in there just to wrap up this part of the discussion? Was the operation a success? I mean, did they paralyze British intelligence?
It probably depends how you see the necessity of the operation. I mean, a lot of accounts present Bloody Sunday as a kind of a masterstroke of genius by Collins, just as British intelligence were about to close in them and roll up the whole kind of IRA network in Dublin. They had this counterstroke. I think it's more along the lines of Brian's suggestion that it's a deliberate, calculated, very dramatic political act, which is meant to send out a clear message. I mean, again, if you think about the sort of the wider context, the auxiliaries are coming in large numbers to Dublin. They're gaining ground or increasing pressure on the IRA. There's also a sense that they seem kind of invulnerable. You know, the IRA isn't actually doing very much in Dublin at this time. So it's a very dramatic gesture in that sense. Some IRA accounts claim that the British Secret Service was paralyzed or even wiped out. I think those accounts don't really stand up. I mean, obviously, there's an enormous kind of temporary impact, which is very significant. People go fleeing back to Dublin Castle, and people change how they were their methods and so on. But if you look at the broader sweep of what's happening in terms of British intelligence, there's a very slow drift towards a kind of professionalization of intelligence gathering. It's a slow kind of slog involving kind of developing systematic processes rather than, the background to this, of course, is that G Division's capabilities were wiped out previously, but the army is certainly gaining ground, but it's probably not really got into its stride at the time of Bloody Sunday. So Bloody Sunday doesn't really stop that slow process of more and more effective military intelligence gathering. The other point to make too is if you look at what happens immediately after Bloody Sunday, I mean, I think 500 people are arrested the following week. So, I mean, there's a it hasn't really dented the counterinsurgency impact. So I think if you're looking at it as a success, it's probably a success in terms of how it was originally planned. It's a success in terms of its dramatic political impact, and it really, particularly how it's kind of perceived back in Britain, it really shatters Lloyd George's narrative of having murder by the throat.
Brian Hanley, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely correct, and we probably underestimate the shock that it did cause. I mean, up till this point, policemen had been shot in the street and so on, but these men were shot in their beds, sometimes in the presence of their wives. And people in Britain found this horrific. I mean, the headlines in the British press, blackest day in history, these are veterans of the First World War, mostly decorated men, shot down, you know, often unarmed, or they hadn't got a chance to get to their arms anyway. So that aspect of the day causes huge shock, and it brings home the seriousness in Britain of what's happening in Ireland. I think the protective gates go up on Downing Street after Bloody Sunday, because they realise that, you know, the IRA, the way they would have seen it, is now the IRA are essentially capable of anything. And again, coming in a situation in Dublin where there hadn't been that intensity of violence that you'd seen elsewhere, it is hugely shocking for Dublin Castle, for the British military and the Crown Forces in Dublin itself, and also then for British public opinion. Now, that can go two ways. One section of British public opinion is obviously, well, then we go in there and we kill all these people. But the other section is, we've got to come to some kind of a compromise here. This has to stop. This can't go on. So it has, you know, a huge political impact. But I should have mentioned in terms of how the IRA feel. Liam Tobin, one of Collins' key men, said after Bloody Sunday that we had no sense of jubilation because Dick McKee and Patrick Clancy had been arrested just before it. And key figures in the Dublin IRA had been arrested just before Bloody Sunday. And of course, as part of the reaction to it, they're murdered. And the Dublin IRA really suffers because of the loss of McKee and Clancy. It's a big, big problem for them. The British can't easily replace good intelligence agents, but they've got lots of soldiers. The IRA finds it harder to replace experienced officers. So again, there's a very careful balance in how these things are working out. But in publicity terms, I think it's very, very successful in bringing home to those in Britain that Ireland is a problem that isn't going to go away easily.
Okay, guys, I want to move on to the afternoon's events at Croke Park. Joe, were the Croke Park killings a reprisal for the morning, or was it a standalone operation? There's different views on this.
I think they were clearly a reprisal. I don't think there was any indication that they were going to raid this particular match at any particular time. I think it came along as a reprisal. All reprisals are reactions. They're always an act of retaliation in one way or another. This was very, very quick, obviously, from 9 o'clock in the morning until the afternoon. But I do think it was a reprisal. I think that they wanted to go in there and they wanted to make some kind of a statement. And of course they did. There are some rumors. I have never been able to substantiate these, that one of the things that was considered was to go burn down O'Connell Street. I've never seen that substantiated in any particular place, but it does indicate a little bit to me that there might've been some discussions about what kind of an action to take. But I do think this was clearly a reaction. I think it was to intimidate people. If we talk about terror later, we can talk about the concept of intimidation and fear and what it does to people. And in fact, I think it was definitely a reaction. It was a reprisal. Reprisals are actually recognized in international law. And this did not really conform in any way to do that. They're usually a way to maintain some kind of redress for what happened. This was not that at all. This was just going in there. It was revenge, I think, pure and simple. And I think that they went in there not with the intent necessary to kill, they did, but I don't think they went in there with a plan. If the original statement, as I understand it, was that they were going to make an announcement, instead of saying stewards to your positions at the end of the match, they were simply going to say, when everybody, the match is over, come through these gates and we're going to search you. That's never going to work. If you had a weapon on you, you'd either just drop it or perhaps give it to someone else, maybe to a lady, and she could hide it in her clothing. But it wasn't going to work in terms of any kind of a search. So I think this was a reprisal, and I think that they simply went out there for revenge.
Okay, Brian, can I bring you in on this? Because is it significant that Tipperary were one of the teams? I mean, you know, would the Castle's view be that this is the IRA at play?
Well, they certainly thought there was a belief that a lot of the gunmen had come up from the country, which was actually untrue in general. I mean, it was the Dublin Brigade who carried out the actions. And they also did think, of course, that they were likely to find a lot of Republicans at this event. And it was a benefit match for Republican prisoners. So, of course, there were going to be some Republicans at least there. But, I mean, to give you, you know, some idea of the kind of nuances, Todd Andrews, who was Dublin Brigade and brought in on that basis into Bloody Sunday, he played a soccer match for UCD the night before. So the Dublin IRA is more diverse than simply people who'd have been at Crow Park on a Sunday. And some people in the Dublin IRA, like Sean Russell, who again had been very involved in the preparation for Bloody Sunday, wanted the match called off. I mean, they thought it was too risky to bring all these people together when there was very likely to be an intense reaction. Another thing that can't be discounted in terms of how the Crown forces behave is that two auxiliaries were among the dead, the British dead on Bloody Sunday. And they essentially died because of their own bad luck. They were walking back to their barracks and they ran into members of the IRA. Now, the auxiliaries tended to behave most viciously when they themselves were targeted. The auxiliaries in Dublin Castle and so on would have wanted revenge immediately. And the idea, again, that, again, comrades of theirs had been shot down and so on the street would have led them to want revenge for this. So, of course, I think the match at Crow Park was an obvious target for the authorities in whatever way they were going to respond.
Yeah, but Brian, the fact is, though, that the Crown Forces were a mixture of auxiliaries, regular army and RIC. And according to the subsequent military report, the most trigger happy people were the RIC people.
Yeah, although again, there's some interdepartmental rivalry in the way they report this, because the auxiliaries claimed, for example, that they didn't fire and that it was more reckless policemen who did. Now, the RIC in Dublin by this point would have included Black and Tans. So again, were present at Crow Park, as were the regular British Army on the perimeter and the surrounding area of Crow Park. And I think the RIC who fired probably included Black and Tans on the day. And again, there is evidence that that auxiliaries did fire themselves, even though they claimed that they hadn't, that they were too well disciplined to do so. And indeed, the British Army's armoured cars outside the ground probably fired around 50 rounds of machine gun fire as a kind of signal at the beginning, and also to try and frighten the people who were there. So all of the Crown Forces are really culpable for what happened.
Now, Fergal, just to bring you in this, right? A reprisal at this scale wasn't unusual at this stage, right? This didn't come out of the blue. I mean, this sort of thing had been happening for months previously, had it not?
The Black and Tans had begun recruitment in January 1920, and about 1,000 of those were joining every month. So there's quite a lot of them on the scene by this point. Then they were joined by the auxiliaries, who, as Brian has mentioned, were a more disciplined, but probably also a more thuggish and a kind of harder force, composed primarily of ex-officers. And they come onto the scene in the summer of 1920. And then we also have the formation of the Ulster Special Constabulary in October. So really what you're seeing in 1920, as the British authorities really begin to take seriously what's happening in Ireland, is a fairly ruthless kind of militarization of policing. They don't want to, for a whole range of reasons, including political but also demands elsewhere, they don't want to bring in more soldiers. So it's easier to create, effectively paramilitarize the police. And the purpose of this is really to use pretty ruthless methods to kind of get a grip on what's happening in Ireland. And they're also supported by the restoration of the Order Act, which comes in that summer, which gives them a lot of power to do things without very much, not very many consequences. The first big reprisal that really generates international attention is the sack of Balbriggan, which takes place in September. And that's very well reported, partly because it happens close to Dublin. And then we also have the burning of Cork, which follows in December. So it's certainly part of a pattern. I think in terms of how we assess the reprisals, I think we need to look at them in military and political terms. And there's this kind of fundamental confusion, I suppose, between the political and military consequences of what repression is achieving this period. I mean, the military effect is obvious. You can really put Republicans under pressure. And you can also put, perhaps more importantly, you can put the nationalist community under pressure through collective punishment, because that's essentially what reprisals are. And certainly it does seem that IRA actions are declining from September. But on the other hand, you know, tactics are evolving. The flying columns are being formed in this period, partly as a response to the auxiliaries and the black and tans, making it very difficult to operate according to the old kind of brigade structures in large numbers. But if you look at the reprisals politically, the kind of the polarization of public opinion in Ireland and the delegitimization of British policy in Britain and internationally is hugely beneficial to Republicans. So Michael Collins quite cheerfully talks about how we're going to be crucified in the course of the year. So in that context, while the military advantages of reprisals are obvious, the political cost was extremely high. And you begin to see the British authorities in Ireland losing considerable legitimacy, even amongst groups of people who would be their supporters. You know, if some unionists, for example, are appalled by what's happening in this period. And I think also we often overlook the impact of British public opinion, because obviously the British government is going to be much more responsive to British public opinion than to Irish public opinion in many respects. And here you see a kind of a wide range of views. I mean, for some people in Britain, what happened on Bloody Sunday, you know, suggests that David Lloyd George is right in talking about a murder gang. The kind of methods of violence that are being used are considered absolutely indefensible. But on the other hand, what happens at Croke Park is enormously damaging for the credibility of the British government's Irish policy. Edward Madigan, in a recent article in Irish Historical Studies, makes the really interesting point that all of this is happening in Britain at the same time that you're seeing the unveiling of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and the cenotaph, and that this is a period in which British public opinion is really focused on the idea of the First World War as a war for civilization and for freedom. So there's a kind of dissonance between how people are supposed to be thinking about the British Army and their kind of moral role and the kind of the news that's coming in from Britain. And for that reason, you see like a broad swathe of British civic opinion and public voices speaking out very strongly against what's happening. And so not just kind of Labour and trade unions and so on, but newspapers like The Times, Anglican bishops, former prime ministers such as Asquith are now very scathing about David Lloyd George policy. And I think that's really crucial in the sort of how politically the reprisals begin to play out, even if they do achieve, you know, considerable military successes in terms of pressuring the IRA.
Okay, I want to move from the broader strategic issues that you talked about there, Fergal, to the victims. Siobhan Doyle, you've been standing by there very patiently. Siobhan, just going back to the victims, the people killed on the day, who was killed and what do we know about them?
Well, there was 14 victims in Croke Park on that Sunday afternoon. Their average age was about 28. So the youngest victim was Jerome O'Leary, who was a schoolboy, and the eldest was 57, Patrick O'Dowd, who's a labourer. I mean, they were working class people. They worked as labourers. Michael Hogan was a farmer. Jane Boyle worked in a butcher's. Daniel Carroll worked in Kennedy's Pub, not far from Croke Park in Drumcondra. So, you know, working class people that went to a match on Sunday afternoon. Now, there is some, I guess, over the years, disparity between the number of victims or who was classified as a victim of that afternoon in Croke Park. In 1970, when the GAA unveiled its first monument to the victim, it listed 13. Now, today, you know, we commemorate for the centenary, we commemorate 14 victims because Tom Hogan was omitted from that memorial plaque in 1970 on the basis that he died a couple of days later in the Mater Hospital. So,
well, the reason that happened, right, I just have some notes here. He was horrendously wounded, right, got gangrene, had his arm amputated, and then died, you know, days later, horrible, painful death. You know, so I mean, I'm glad he was reinstated as one of the victims, because it looks like, and of course, many of the victims then didn't die by gunfire. They were crushed to death. One guy was impaled on a railing, you know. So it wasn't just, it wasn't just gunfire that caused the problem, you know, that did them in. Just a few little details. One of the people was a Thomas Ryan from Wexford, right? And he was shot while whispering an act of contrition in Michael Hogan's ear, you know, for his pains, you know. And I mean, I think that the breakdown is interesting of the victims. Nine of them are from Dublin, three from Tipperary, one from Wexford, and one from Limerick. But there is a fourth Tipperary victim of Bloody Sunday from the morning, which many listeners may not be aware of. But one of the people shot by the squad that morning was an RIC Sergeant John Fitzgerald. Now, Joe tells me this was probably a case of mistaken identity, that they were looking for a Colonel Fitzpatrick. But John Fitzgerald was from Tipperary with major big GAA connections, which is supremely ironic. But Siobhan, just getting back to you. So, I mean, it's fairly scrappy then what we know about them, apart from Michael Hogan. We'll come back to that later. So, I mean, is that correct? Like, that it's fairly scrappy information we have on the people apart from Hogan.
Yes, definitely. It's pretty much aside from Michael Foley's book, The Bloody Fields, there is very little engagement with these individuals. It's only now, as we're approaching the centenary, that there is, further delving into these victims as they lived rather than how they died. Now, thankfully, the centenary is bringing about, more stories and more objects, which means that, you know, we can get a more nuanced and a broader story and, a better engagement with these people as individuals. Thankfully, from the perspective of the GA Museum, we've had many objects that have enriched the new centenary exhibition. For the first time on display, we have Tom Hogan's coat, which he wore. There's a bullet hole in the shoulder, which was patched. You have the cigarette and matches that were found in the coat pocket. And Tom Ryan, that you mentioned there earlier, the Wexford man. We have his prayer book and
that's very appropriate, you know.
Yeah, given absolutely.
How he died, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Just, you mentioned, what else is there? Not just held at the GA Museum, but held by museums generally. What else do we have?
Yeah, so many of the objects are actually coming from private collections and things that are safeguarded by the families themselves. It's interesting that many of them are only, you know, coming forward with these objects now, which is telling of, I suppose, the trauma of that day and the fact that, you know, these items may have been, you know, locked away in a drawer for many years, unspeakable. This event was, you know, difficult for families to talk about. But within the collection of the National Museum of Ireland, we have the waistcoat from the suit that Padraig Clancy was wearing when he was killed. Now, that waistcoat, which is currently on display, it's in two pieces because it had to be cut open at the back to remove it from his body. So these are, you know, extremely, these objects were extremely close to those individuals that are associated with Bloody Sunday. You know, some of them have been repaired. As I said, Tom Hogan's coat, they've patched it up, but some of them lie in their bloodstained, in their torn, in their worn state.
Now, Siobhan, would it be true to say, though, that curators like yourself are a lot more rigorous now but you know, tracking down the origin of artifacts than maybe in former years?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we do have technology and for example, as Jane Sutcliffe mentioned on a previous podcast, that, you know, ballistics experts have been involved in decoding these objects, and Michael Hogan's jersey in the Tipperary County Museum. We also have more resources, which makes provenance research that little bit easier for those of us that are delving down. But unfortunately, with an event that's, 100 years ago, it can be difficult to trace those objects. So we need to tread carefully on those stories.
And also the results of the research can be a bit disappointing, because what Jane explained in that podcast is that the jersey, which was given to the Tipperary local museum as the jersey that Michael Hogan wore on the day, is not the jersey he wore on the day, because for starters, it's not riddled with bullet holes. It is a jersey worn by Michael Hogan. Incidentally, the same jersey will be worn by the Tipperary team in next week's Munster final, which is interesting. I mean, who knew the Tipperary were a power in football? But that's another discussion entirely. So, are you into the sort of relics of the True Cross situation here, that all sorts of stuff will be sent in as being, a direct connection with this event?
Well, I mean, we're dependent a lot on oral history of stories that are handed down from families. And in terms of, as research looking into objects in these collections, it's the nature of archives as well that, from a curatorial point of view or from people that are donating, there's not this self-conscious documentation and meticulous details that we do now when an object does enter a collection. So unfortunately, that's just down to, the traditions or the way things were done many years ago. So it's unfortunate, but that's what we've got to work with.
Now, in that same podcast, Aegon O'Farrell, former GAA president, says that the GAA Museum does have a Michael Hogan's jersey. There's a rather mischievous intervention by Aegon. Of course, it's the jersey worn by the actor in the Michael Jordan, Michael Collins film. Any comment on that, Siobhan, on the influence of that film?
Aegon was right. There's two replica jerseys on display in the GAA Museum, and they were, of course, from Neil Jordan's Michael Collins film. I suppose the jerseys exist in the collection because of, the actual jerseys, they don't exist. So, we've had to make do with a replica. And I suppose that's indicative of, the unfortunate lack of survival of a lot of these objects and a lot of these, I've yet to see a jersey from a Dublin player from that day, for example, which is a real shame. But, the replicas are just standing in for what we long to have in the collection, which is, an original Dublin jersey from that day.
Well, I've been Brian in on this, Brian, because in a way, though, I mean, I would have thought it's entirely appropriate that stuff from the Jordan film would be displayed. I mean, how influential has the film been? I mean, I know you have complained about the stuff you get back from undergraduates occasionally. Just talk to us about that.
I mean, I think it's been hugely influential, Tommy, and it's shaped really the way that a generation of people in Ireland have viewed the War of Independence. But something just struck me there in thinking about that, because, I mean, we can nitpick about various aspects of it, but one thing which the film doesn't do, and which also I think is important to remember when we're talking about violence in Dublin, is that Dublin was the centre of civil resistance to the British administration. And sometimes when we talk about the War of Independence, particularly when we look at Collins as a guerrilla leader, we forget that one of the reasons why the British were not able to bring things under control was that a huge section of the population had withdrawn allegiance, and that in Dublin, the majority of IRA members never shot anybody. They took, if you look at the pension files, they'll write down, paraded at Mountjoy to Stewart during hunger strikes. So thousands of people are on the streets during hunger strikes in Mountjoy. Thousands are taking part in strikes and boycotts and so on, and in demonstrations are outside Mountjoy again when Kevin Barry is being hanged. And that aspect is kind of missing from the Michael Collins movie, as it is from a lot of accounts which see this as purely a kind of nighttime subterranean struggle between two elite groups of fighters, when in actual fact it was much broader than that. And of course, the thousands who turned up at Croke Park for a match which was to raise money for Republican prisoners are also reflective of the fact that this was a popular struggle in many ways. So I think the Collins movie is hugely influential, but you've got to go beyond it to kind of understand what was going on.
Can I just make one observation on the Collins movie? One positive is that in the popular mind, I think it is definitely coupled, you know, the shootings at Croke Park with what happened in the morning. Because I would have thought, you know, amongst the general public, that direct connection might not have been made. But listen, I want to move on. Joe, I want to come to you because Siobhan mentioned Father Clancy's waistcoat. Because just very quickly, because I want to get this out of the way before we forget it, what happened to, that evening to Clancy McKee and the unfortunate Clune?
Well, let's start the night before very quickly, Tommy. Peter Clancy and Dick McKee were in a meeting in Gardiner Street, and they determined that a couple of British agents had changed residence. So they changed the plan a little bit for the individuals to go out there. They were late. We talked earlier about the one thing that was just definitely bad for the British intelligence agents. It was just as bad for the Irish. That's the curfew. They were out after curfew. They tried to get away from there. They went to Sean Fitzpatrick House on what is now Sean McDermott Street. And they were seen by a British tout by the name of John Shankers Ryan, who turned them into the British, said, I see these two people. I don't think he knew exactly how important they were or what was going on, but he turned them in. Then, according to all the accounts, he put a chalk mark on the door. The British came, arrested them, took them to Dublin Castle during the nighttime before and kept them there all day. Conor Clune was, just as you say, is very unfortunate. He came up to see Pierce Beasley at Vaughan's Hotel for GAA matters and Gaelic League matters, I should say. I'm sorry. He was a Gaelic League scholar. He wanted to talk to Pierce Beasley. He was in Vaughan's Hotel. Most of the Irish personnel had left Vaughan's Hotel that night, but he did not. He was caught up in the raid that was done there. Again, he was taken to the Dublin Castle. And when the events of the morning took place, they were in the guard room of Dublin Castle. Most of the other people that were arrested that night, including Sean Fitzpatrick from the house of that McKee and Clancy were taken, were moved out there. But these people, these three, were left in Dublin Castle in this guard room, and then they were killed that evening. Now, there's been some controversy over were they bayoneted. They certainly were probably beaten. They were certainly probably tortured. Some of the people said they weren't bayoneted. Some of the others said that they were. They just definitely were killed as reprisals and very definitely for it. Was it luck? Probably, because John Shankers Ryan was well known in that area. He was actually the brother of one of the madams of Monto, Becky Cooper. And some people say he was also her fancy man and kind of acted as a pimp as well. But he caught them just absolutely by luck and turned them in. Conor Clune, again, he was arrested by his very, very bad luck just in a raid on Vaughan's Hotel. And Vaughan's Hotel was raided quite often during these times, so he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Then they ended up at Dublin Castle, and that's where they were killed.
Okay, guys, let's move on to the whole question of commemoration. Siobhan, if I could come back to you, has there been an overemphasis on the martyrdom of Michael Hogan?
Well, if by martyrdom we're thinking about the elevation of the story of one individual at the expense of others, then yes, I believe so. I believe so, absolutely. And that's evident, you know, even in the hours after Bloody Sunday. I mean, the Monday morning afterwards, you have members of the public coming into Croke Park to say prayers at the spot where he had died. And that exact spot in Croke Park is still, and for many years after that, in commemorations after that, was held with such reverence. Rosaries recited, and you know, ceremonies held at that exact spot. So yeah, his martyrdom was evident from the very start. And you know, Hogan in 1928, the GA erected a substantial monument at his grave in Grangemouth, a large white marble monument at the family plot. And when you think of that in contrast with the many of the other victims who until the last couple of years lay in unmarked graves in Glasnevin Cemetery, it's complete. The martyrdom is completely evident, yes. And it's that you know, Hogan had a stand named after him before Maurice Davin and before Frank Dineen, who were absolutely crucial in the early development of the GAA.
And they're much better tickets as well, you know, if they're Hogan's stand. Now, just on the question of the unmarked graves, though, right? But there was a joint GAA Glasnevin and Trust project, was it not, Siobhan, which redressed that issue.
There was, yeah. So that was instigated a couple of years ago. Jane Boyle in 2015, she was the first of the victims to have a headstone erected in Glasnevin Cemetery. So this Bloody Sunday Graves Project was instigated by the GAA in conjunction with the author Michael Foley and with Glasnevin Trust, who went to great painstaking research to verify the final resting places of these victims in the unmarked graves. And then they made contact with relatives where possible and provided assistance if necessary to remember them by erecting brand new headstones.
And in that previous headstone, by the way, Aegon O'Fairyld has told us that there's only two unmarked graves left, so that project has almost been completed. But listen, just again, just getting back to the issue of how we remember these events, Joe Connell, should these events at home in the morning and the afternoon be considered as terror?
I mean, when we talk about terror, there are various definitions of terror. There are legal definitions, there are military definitions, ethical, philosophical definitions. Brian has written very eloquently about terror, and we always take a look at all these different definitions. And when you have different definitions, very often it's difficult to find the one that matches exactly what you want. But I've tried to distill some of this to come down to various things and to put them into a particular definition. We'd look at acts of violence or threats of future violence that are directed at combatants or maybe civilians or non-combatants, and they're intended to induce fear in a population or somewhere else in order to achieve a particular goal. And I think in this particular way, we can look at these both the morning and the afternoon as terrorist events. Remember, if you go back to the French Revolution, Voltaire, pour encourager les autres, and please forgive my terrible French accent, but to encourage the others. Who are the others that we are encouraging? Certainly, British officers would have been very definitely terrorized. They all ran to Dublin Castle that afternoon. People who were renting their houses might have been terrorized. They might never wanted to do it again. Somebody who was attempted to talk to some of the British, they might not want to do that if they were Irish because they feel what would happen to them. Terrorism always targets a few in a way that affects a great many. Let me just read something here very quickly, something from a man who was at Croke Park that afternoon. His name is Ned Corcoran. He was a member of the 5th Division, I'm sorry, the 5th Battalion, and he went to that match, and he said afterwards, "Now when I go to the matches and see a large carefree crowd, the flag flying, the bands playing, the national anthem, and a plane is heard, and you know it's a friendly one, such a change." What did he think about every time he went to a match after he had gone to Croke Park? He was intimidated. He might have been fearful. That's exactly what these things were intended to do on both the Irish side and the British side when they went into Croke Park. We're looking at all definitions come back to intimidation, fear, changing the lives of people, their ordinary lives as the UN defines it today. And we have to take a look at this. This was to get rid of some agents. It was to scare off some agents in the morning. It was to buy time. And then it was to basically tell the Irish people, we are here. We might not have been doing very much in Dublin, but we're right there and be aware of us. So I think that intimidation, that fear in the morning, in my view, makes it a terrorist kind of event. The afternoon, I think, is clearly one because of the reprisal, the revenge, the actions that were taken by the British there.
Yeah, but is there a difference? And Brian or Fergal could come in this if they wish. Is there a difference between the morning and the afternoon in that the morning are targeted, surgical strikes, if you like? You could say, an act of war against quote-unquote legitimate targets. Whereas the afternoon, the victims are, quote-unquote innocent civilians. I mean, surely there's a moral difference there. Brian or Fergal, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a difference. And I think a lot of the definitions of terrorism do talk about the deliberate targeting of civilians or non-involved people as kind of integral to terrorism, whereas the attacks on the morning of Bloody Sunday were on combatants. Those British officers were engaged in a war in Ireland, were targeting the IRA. Of course, within the actual carrying out of those attacks, you have people who aren't necessarily the intended targets, and this tends to happen within any kind of armed campaign. But I do think there is a difference between the targeted or intended to be targeted assassinations in the morning and the reprisal at Croke Park. I mean, there is a wider discussion then about the entire campaign, but certainly I think the politically at the time, the British were very keen to paint the IRA as a murder gang or as terrorists, and they would have rejected that label.
Fergal, could I bring you in? This? Yeah, sorry, I'm going to go to you anyway, Fergal, which is, even if, you know, no matter how horrendous you see the assassinations of the morning, right, regardless of whether they're targeted or not, is it not a fact that it brought the British to the negotiating table, or it made them certainly think about coming to the negotiating table? So there is a positive moral side to this whole thing, possibly.
Well, just to jump in on the last point, Tommy, about is it kind of terrorism? I mean, you find quite a lot of the accounts by Republicans are quite frank about this being a type of violence, a type of ruthlessness that hadn't been seen before very widely, and which a lot of people had a lot of difficulty with. Todd Andrews, for example, who did participate in Bloody Sunday, had refused to join the squad, and I think he wasn't alone in that. He wrote, "Killing a man in cold blood was alien to our ideas of how war should be conducted." And one of the things I'm kind of struck by is, if you compare the types of violence from the Easter Rising, which in some ways could be seen almost as a sort of a chivalrous form of violence in a way, it's quite conventional, to this guerrilla warfare and assassination, and then of course to the Civil War. And you look at the kind of people who are involved also in doing some of the most disturbing killings of the Civil War are these people who were involved in Bloody Sunday. I think you can usefully think about terms. I mean, I think the term terrorism isn't very helpful, but the kind of the brutalization that occurs when people use types of violence and become experienced killers. And an awful lot of the killing was done by a relatively small group of people. So I think on both sides, on the Irish and on the British side, there was a very deliberate policy of using terror and intimidation to achieve political ends. In terms of the whether Bloody Sunday led directly to negotiations, I mean, I think the shock effect, the perception that the IRA was a determined force was probably more important than its actual military impact. If you look at, for example, there's a lot of coverage of this. You can the return of the coffins from Dublin. Crowds line the Liffey as the bodies are taken to the North Wall.
The British victims.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The British victims. You can see this very striking footage on Pathé, which you can see of the procession from Whitehall to Westminster Abbey of like a large number of coffins. So that, I think that's quite important in terms of its impact on British public opinion. Interestingly enough, British politicians are a much more cynical bunch. They're often much less sympathetic. Arthur Griffith receives a message from David Lloyd George the day after Bloody Sunday, urging him not to break off links. So there's all sorts of peace feelers going on at this time. And the message apparently reads, "Tragic as the events were, they were of no importance. These men were soldiers and took a soldier's risk." So I think if you're thinking about the negotiations, and they're still a long way off, you're still looking at next summer when they finally, the puzzle comes together. But I think really you're looking at political factors. The establishment of Northern Ireland is a really important piece of the groundwork that has to be laid. And I think also the other really important factor in a lot of this is the international context. Winston Churchill makes a fascinating speech, a famous speech, the Curt Hall speech, in which he kind of makes the case to Tories, to kind of conservative British public opinion, about why Britain should make a generous political offer to a group of people they'd called terrorists and murderers. And basically his central point is, we need to stem the damage that Ireland is doing to the Anglo-American alliance. So it's really interesting how that kind of wider international context plays into this. But I do think a fundamental part of what, and I'd agree very much with Brian is saying, this is primarily a revolutionary and a political kind of strategy, but sustaining a military IRA campaign is obviously an important part of that overall revolutionary equation.
Siobhan, I'm going to finish up on this one. Can you help us out here with any kind of new paradigms for commemorating Bloody Sunday?
Yeah, I suppose the centenary has brought about from what I view as a more balanced and equal commemoration, certainly of the 14 victims that afternoon. You know, the victim, it's no longer Michael Hogan and 13 others. You know, they're you know, given equal footing. You know, as I mentioned earlier, there's more engagement with their lives rather than their deaths. So overall, it's more balanced. The commemorations have been derailed somewhat by the present situation that we're in. But I mean, there has been, the commemorative program has kept, the backbone of the commemorative program is still happening. But you know what I think is going to be the legacy of this centenary commemorations is the new the not only the breaking down of barriers between Michael Hogan and the other victims, but it's the visual paradigm that the centenary brings. You know, we have the GA who have brought 14 videos, one to represent each of the victims. So we have films, we have theatres involved, we have paintings. We now have visual representations of each of the 14 victims for the first time ever. New objects and new stories coming forward all the time. So all of these new stakeholders are bringing in a much more nuanced remembrance to this extremely complex moment in Irish history.
I tell you, I'll chip in just to wrap up. My favourite commemoration of the events of Bloody Sunday was on the 26th of February 2007. Ireland 43, England 13. Yeah, vengeance was sweet. Listen, I'd like to thank our panel today: Joe Connell, Siobhan Doyle, Brian Hanley, and Fergal McGarry. Now we've mentioned previous hedge schools relating to Bloody Sunday: the West Awake Revolution in Roscommon. A big chunk of that is about Paddy Moran, who was one of the shooters on the morning. Commemorating Bloody Sunday in the Junior Cycle History Classroom, that's another one. And then we had a third hedge school, Bloody Sunday, the Tipperary Connection. That's good on the GAA aspects. But listen, listeners, check those out, and I hope you tune into our next hedge school, which will be the Government of Ireland Act, 100 years of partition, and that will be uploaded on the 1st of December. Hope to talk to you then. Thank you.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.